So good morning everyone, and welcome to Yeshi Buddhist Group, and welcome to this one day event we've got titled here, Mind and Meditation. I think the topic is based on the fact that the work that the monthly meetings they're doing is sort of covering roughly that area at the moment, so we're trying to supplement that with this today. So today we've got four sessions. We've got from now until about 11:15, then we'll have a tea break. And then about 11:30 to 12:30, the second session. And then lunch will be 12:30 to 1:30. And then 1:30 till 2:45, we'll have the third session, another tea break, and then 3 to 4, finishing at 4 o'clock this afternoon. So how we're roughly going to break the sessions is, the topic again is mind and meditation. So the first session will be looking at the mind. What is the mind and what do we mean by mind according to Buddhism? The second session will be, you know, what is meditation and the different types of meditation and what's the purpose of doing meditation. The third session will be looking at one of the really foundational meditation practices. And then the fourth session will be how to sort of integrate meditation into our daily life so that we can gain benefit from it. So that's roughly what the four sessions are going to cover. In each of the sessions, there'll be some discussion, there'll be a meditation, time for a question answer as well. In fact, in all my classes, I like to be very interactive, so I don't really like just stand there and talk a lot and then maybe some questions at the end, which means that in anything I'm discussing, if you have some questions, then please raise your hand and we'll try and answer that as we go. So I like to be as interactive as possible, so don't be afraid to ask questions. Maybe before I start, just to help me a little bit, how many of you already have a little bit of familiarity with the Buddhist idea of mind and meditation? How many of you? Is there anyone that sort of has really no understanding whatsoever?
I'm not sure about the Buddhist. I've done other sorts of meditation.
Okay, so basically most of us have done something in this field. So I'll try and be as clear as possible and we'll see how we go. Okay, so let's start by looking at this session of what is the mind. Of course, it's a huge topic, and mind, of course, there are many philosophies of mind in the world today. We're going to be focusing on the Buddhist theory of mind, and the reason that the mind is such a important part of Buddhism, of course, is that the Buddhist assertion is that the source of our suffering and the source of our happiness is not out there anywhere to be found. It's within our own mind. So what we need to do, of course, is we need to work with our own mind. We need to transform our mind. We need to reduce and overcome the causes of suffering. We need to develop the causes of happiness within our own mind. So since the focal point of everything we do is the mind, it's good to know a little bit about what the mind is so that we have some clarity on that, so we really know what we're doing when we're talking about transforming the mind. First, just a little bit of terminology, because often you'll find that a lot of confusion, not just in Buddhism but in general, comes from terminology. And particularly in Buddhism, which of course has its roots 2,000 years ago in the ancient languages of Sanskrit and Pali, the terms used in those languages were very precise in meaning. But then when they go to translate these into other languages, particularly into English, what we often find is that a number of these terms, very important terms, there is no word in English that has the same meaning, so the translator is forced to pick a word that sort of approximates it. But unfortunately, often that word in English, in our daily language, has a lot of other meanings. So when people use that word, then people automatically think, oh, it means this, when in fact, actually it doesn't, or it means something slightly different. So I'm going to try and clarify some of these important terms today and what their meaning is within Buddhism rather than maybe the everyday usage of that word. So first here, of course, the word mind. There are three words we use when we speak generally about this topic of mind, and that is mind, consciousness, awareness. So when we speak very generally, then these three words mean the same thing. Even within those words, sometimes when we speak more specifically, they can take on a slightly different meaning. But here today, in general, when we're speaking, you can assume that mind equals consciousness equals awareness. The term we have to really be careful with is this one. And in Buddhism, this word is used a lot in different traditions. And unfortunately, different translators use that same word to translate quite different terms within Buddhism. So this word awareness is a little bit of a minefield. So we have to be very careful when we hear people use the word awareness. It can mean many different things. But today, in general, when I use the word awareness, it just means mind and consciousness. Sometimes you'll find in some Buddhist traditions this word awareness is talking about a very specific type of mind. And sometimes people use the word awareness, as we're going to see shortly, as the function of the mind. And sometimes the word awareness is used as this ability to monitor our own mind, which normally is translated as like introspection. But sometimes people use the word awareness for that. So we have to be very careful when we hear this word awareness and really try and understand what is this person really talking about here when they're using this word. But today in general, when I'm using it, mind equals consciousness equals awareness in very general terms. So let's start with a simple definition of mind in Buddhism. A very simple definition of mind in Buddhism is the mind is that which is clear and knowing. Sometimes this is translated as mind is that which has clarity and awareness. So here you see the word awareness, and here the word awareness, this second word is talking about the function of the mind. What does the mind do? Whereas the first word in this definition is talking about the entity of the mind. What is the entity of the mind itself? You'll often find in Buddhism these two-word definitions. And like a simple example here is the definition of fire is hot and burning. So what is the entity of fire? Is heat. That's the entity or the nature of fire. What does fire do? It burns. So similarly here, mind is that which is clear and knowing or has clarity and awareness. What is the sort of the nature of the mind? The nature of the mind is that it is clear or it has clarity. What does the mind do? It knows, it is aware. So let's briefly look at these two words in a little bit more detail. So the first word, clear or clarity, that the entity of the mind, the nature of the mind is clear or has clarity. What does that really mean? That implies at least two things. The first, the fact that the mind is clear or has clarity, is implying that the mind is not physical, i.e. it's not the brain. So, of course, there are some theories of mind, particularly in what's called scientific materialism, which actually equates the mind with the brain. So often in neuroscience, when they talk about the brain, in the same breath, they'll use the word mind. So that is one theory of mind, which says the mind effectively is the brain, the function of the brain, or what's called an emergent property of the brain. So often in the scientific materialistic field, this is how mind is defined. Of course, here in Buddhism, we're saying actually that the mind, when we say that the mind is clear or has clarity, one implication is in fact that the mind is not the brain. It's not an emergent property of the brain. They are closely related, of course, They are interrelated. So Buddhism's not saying that the mind and brain are sort of two unrelated things. But what we're saying here is that we're not equating them as the same thing. So that's one implication of what means for the mind to be clear or have clarity. It's not physical, so it's not the brain. The other meaning of the word clear or clarity is the mind being clear, having clarity, means that therefore it allows objects to appear in it. Similarly, like a mirror, because a mirror is clear, reflections can appear in the mirror. Because the mind is clear, then thoughts, emotions, mental images, memories can appear in the mind. So that's the idea of clarity. Because it's clear, therefore things can appear within it. Thoughts, emotions, memories, mental images. Then the function of the mind is the mind knows, it is aware. So not only do we have appearances appearing in the mind like thoughts, emotions, mental images and so forth, but the mind engages in those appearances, aware of those appearances. So that is what the word to know, the mind knows or is aware. So that is a very simple definition of the mind. And, you know, often then people talk about this, you know, oh, according to Buddhism, the mind is clear and knowing or has clarity and awareness. And so it's easy to quote those words, but what does that really mean? You know, do we really understand what those two words imply, what it really means? So this is where I think it's important that in Buddhism it's not about being smart, you know, it's not about knowing lots of good things or cool things, but, you know, we can be the smartest person in the world and still be miserable. So Buddhism's not about having some new intellectual philosophy. The Buddha was never a philosopher. He wasn't a philosopher, he was a doctor. So therefore, it's important here and in every facet of Buddhism is not just pick up lots of cool new ideas, because they in themselves are not going to really change our life very much. What we need to do is we need to come to internalize those ideas, bring them from intellectual understanding into experience. So therefore, it's much more important to experientially see what the mind is rather than be able to very eloquently parrot those words, the mind is clear and knowing, because it doesn't really mean anything to us. So that's actually what we're going to do now. We're going to do a short meditation and try to come to experientially see that the mind is clear and knowing or has clarity and awareness. So then when we think about those words, we can, from our own experience, we can go, oh yeah, maybe it's this we're talking about. So that's what we're going to do now before we continue on, because I want to talk more about the mind in more detail, but I think it's good as a basis to try to experientially understand the mind in this way, and then we can go on in our discussion. So we're going to do a short meditation now, very simple one, to try and connect with these two ideas of clear and knowing or clarity and awareness. So if you just like to find a nice comfortable posture. So again, we're sitting in a chair, so it's good to have the feet flat on the ground. The hands, you can just rest in your lap. Some in the Tibetan tradition, often with meditation, you'll find people put their right hand in the left, thumbs touching and resting in the lap like this. That's symbolizing these two aspects of practice of wisdom and compassion and the fact that we need to integrate them. But if you find that a little bit awkward, then you can just rest them in your lap or put them on your knees, just comfortable with your arms. So again, feet flat on the floor and keeping the back nice and straight and the body relaxed. So these are the two key elements of any meditation posture, is relax the body and keep the back straight. So let's do a little meditation and I'll guide us through the meditation. So as an act of loving kindness for yourself, allow your awareness to descend into the body and simply become aware of sensations throughout the body. And if you notice any areas of tightness or tension in any part of the body, then use the out-breath to relax and release that tightness or tension to the best of your ability. And then bring your awareness to the area of your face and soften and relax all the muscles in the face, the mouth and jaw soft and relaxed, and all the muscles around the eyes soft and relaxed. In this way, allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. Simply allow the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Not trying to control or regulate the breath in any way. Simply allowing it to flow naturally and effortlessly. And relaxing more deeply with every out-breath. And then give yourself permission to let go of any hopes or fears, worries or concerns about the past or the future for the duration of this short meditation. Simply letting go of all of these things and allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. And simply focus on the sensations of the breath throughout the body, wherever you can most distinctly notice any sensations associated with the breathing. Now let go of focusing on the sensations of the breath and simply rest in the mind itself. Rest in awareness itself. In other words, simply be aware of being aware. The function of the mind is to be aware. Normally we are aware of objects, but here, just be aware of the fact of being aware. Just know you're aware and rest in that experience. Now all sorts of appearances will continue to arise. Thoughts and emotions and memories and images will continue to arise. But here, pay no attention to any appearance and simply rest in being aware of being aware. Resting in awareness itself. And slowly finish this meditation and continue our discussions together. So how did you find that? Was it easy? Was it a complicated meditation? No. Why did we find, probably most of you found that quite difficult? Not because it was complicated or technical. Why do we find it difficult?
Because the mind
this racing, constant bombardment of thoughts.
I thought it was nice.
Yeah. But, I mean, even if there is a constant bombardment of thoughts, can't we still simply be aware of being aware? Isn't that still possible, even if there's lots of thoughts appearing?
Yeah.
Isn't that possible? But probably the experience is you got caught up in the thoughts, didn't you?
And then you come back and you're like, oh, I'm aware that I got these thoughts and I was following them, but now I'm not. But then,
so again, this meditation is not complicated. It's not technical. In fact, the reason people find it so difficult is because it's too easy. I mean, not too easy, too simple. Because, again, we are all caught up in appearances. We're always caught up in appearance. Some appearance comes, whether it's external or internal, whether it's a visual appearance or a thought, and immediately we identify with it, we follow it, get caught up in it, and we contract around these appearances, and our mind seems to become very small and constricted. And so this is our state. And here, we're simply trying to simply be aware of being aware. And we find it difficult because of that fact. In fact, there was we're so much addicted to stimulus and activity. There was actually, because this meditation was about 15 minutes, and they did last year, Time magazine did a survey. They put people in a plain room. There was nothing in the room, white walls, chair in the middle, and they had to sit in the chair for 15 minutes. And the only thing they gave them was a little device that could give themselves an electrical shock. So either they sat there with their mind for 15 minutes, and 65% of men decided to shock themselves because they couldn't sit there because they're so addicted to stimulus. Women fared better. Only 25% of women decided to shock themselves. I think one guy, they said, shocked themselves 90 times in 15 minutes. So this is a state of our mind. So if we can simply rest in awareness itself, then this is really a good way to stop grasping onto appearances. And if we can rest in awareness, then we can experientially start to see these two qualities, the clarity of the mind and the knowing, the awareness function of the mind. So this is a very good type of meditation to really come to experientially see these qualities of the mind. And of course, if we can rest in awareness itself, one is we're not chasing after appearances. So that state of awareness that you may have had little glimpses of, the mind is this, it's a state of stillness, complete stillness and spaciousness, completely unbounded state of spaciousness. So if we can stay in that state, it's a very peaceful, calm state. And then even if appearances arise in the mind, as long as we don't identify with them and follow them, we can stay in that open, spacious, still state in the midst of all appearances. So if we can cultivate this in meditation, this is great for daily life. It means that we can be in a busy life, which most of us are, in the midst of all sorts of stimulus and appearances, and yet stay in that very calm, open, spacious, still state and not grasp onto appearances. So not only can we gain some experiential access to the conventional nature of the mind, but it has a lot of benefit in daily life. Anyone would like to add anything to this meditation before we move on?
What about, you know, if you've been doing it quite a while, like I am, on and off, and I used to get all that distraction going on, total chaos, and just applied myself to it, and over the course of several years, reached a point where, yes, I could let go, and yes, I could relax and sit here. And then I gave up for a while. And every time I go back to meditation, like we've just done now, all I get is a complete blank.
Complete,
you know, calm.
Yeah.
But blank.
Yeah.
So I'm not invaded by all this, you know,
sure,
appearances. I'm not grasping onto anything.
Sure.
But I've reached a state of complete boredom.
And that's exactly the other point, is that for us, there seems to be two possibilities. You know, there's all this appearances which often we don't cope with very well, and we get caught up in it, and we don't know how to deal with it. So what's the solution is to, instead of getting caught up in it, is to cut from appearances. So we go inward, but we end up in this blank state where we're not in the, we're not present with appearances, but we are cutting from appearances, and we're deliberately blanking out appearances and exactly ending up in this blank state because we can't deal with stimulus. So that's the other extreme.
Actually, I'm not having to make that effort even.
Right, but
it's literally nothing is going on.
Right. So there's two things I wanted to mention. That's coming to the second point, yeah. Is that often people then use these sorts of meditation practices as a way of withdrawing from all that stimulus because they can't cope with it. This is not healthy. That's the other extreme. The one extreme is getting caught up and getting overwhelmed. The other extreme is withdrawing and cutting from all appearances. I mean, that's completely unhealthy. So that's one, but that's probably not where you're going.
Somewhere I am.
No, but I'm...
So I came from the complete overwhelmed bit.
Sure.
That's the reason I came into meditation.
Sure.
Was to deal with that.
Right.
And over the course of several years, I managed to do that, and I'm calmed down now, completely calm, but...
Right, so I wanted to mention this first because, unfortunately, often people use meditation wrongly in this way as a way of withdrawing into their little bubble of peace and go, oh, that's so nice. I don't have to deal with all that mess out there. No, but I'm just mentioning that first. But that's, unfortunately, what a lot of people do. That's not healthy. The other thing that can happen, and that's probably in your case, is that when we start to rest in awareness and not get caught up in appearances, we end up in a very dull state. Because now, again, usually we're in one of two modes. When we're alert, we tend to be very tense and caught up in everything.
Right.
And then when we relax, we become completely dull.
Yeah.
So, yeah, therefore...
Now I'm in a state of now what?
Yeah, that's... Well, that's one of the topics from today, in fact. In session, in the second...
Came to the right place.
In all the next three sessions, I'm going to answer your question.
Yeah.
But the very brief answer now is that what we're trying to do is to become relaxed, not get caught up in appearances, but at the same time be alert and be connected with the world. That's the challenge. Because we go from one to the other. We get caught up in the world, tense, stressed, agitated, or we withdraw, become relaxed, but completely dull and disconnected. So what we're trying to do is combine the two in terms of being relaxed, yet alert and connected. That's the challenge, and we're going to talk about how to do that today.
I just asked you before we go on, because the thing I find... and so on.
Sure.
Put your mind back, keep bringing it back. It's great when you get a glimpse of the awareness of being aware. And I must say, that's a fantastic way of putting it. I've never come across anybody before who's put it like that.
Mm.
And it gives a label, a concept to exactly what it is.
Mm.
But my concern or irritation I find with myself is that thoughts come in. And before I know where I am, and I think maybe it's lacking alertness, I'm off following them.
Exactly.
And 10 minutes has gone by.
Exactly.
Where was I?
Exactly.
And so is that a lack of alertness? Is that mental sinking?
Yeah, that is. So we're going to be looking at this as well today, starting in the next session, is that, in fact, exactly that's what happens, is that we now, our mindfulness... is very poorly developed, meaning that when we try to rest in this state where easily an appearance comes, we automatically get caught and get carried away. So that's a lack of mindfulness, basically. So what we are trying to do, and that's what we're going to be focusing on mainly in the coming sessions, is how to cultivate this mindfulness, how to strengthen our mindfulness so that, one, we can be in that state or whatever we're focusing on in meditation longer. And likewise, together with that, is when we notice or when we become distracted or become dull, to notice that quickly and adjust and come back. So now, of course, as you said, we try to rest in this experience or whatever, and we're distracted within a few seconds, and then maybe 5 minutes later we go, oh, hang on, I'm supposed to be doing this. And then we come back to it for another few seconds, and then we're gone again for 5 minutes. And so it's not that we're doing the meditation wrong, it's just that we need to train the muscle of mindfulness. And so that's all we need to do. And the more we strengthen that, the more we can stay in that state. And then if we get distracted or become dull, we recognize it quickly and come back to that state. And the more we do that in meditation, the more we familiarize ourselves with that, the more automatic that becomes in daily life to be in that state. Because again, in daily life, we can say, okay, I'm just going to be calm amongst all of this. I'm going to do that. But of course, it doesn't work, does it? Because our habit is to get caught up and react and so forth. So we need to strengthen this faculty of mindfulness in meditation. And then in daily life, we can start to really implement this. So we're going to be talking about this. This is all coming, all coming. Right, let's go on and talk a little bit more about the mind, trying to get a little bit deeper understanding of mind according to Buddhism. And of course, mind is a huge topic, and there are many different presentations of mind in Buddhism. And we're going to briefly touch on three presentations, looking at the mind from different perspectives. The first is to look at the mind in terms of the objects that we experience. Now, with our mind, we can experience, of course, the so-called five sense objects. We can experience visual objects, sounds, smells, tastes, tactile sensations. But also with our mind, we can experience mental objects, such as emotions, thoughts, and memories. So because we can experience six types of objects, we can talk about what's called the six consciousness. We can talk about what's called the five sense consciousnesses and the mental consciousness. Of course, here we're not talking about six separate minds. There's only one mind. But within the one mind we have six aspects in terms of the types of objects we experience. So, for example, in the sense consciousness, what's called the visual consciousness is that aspect of the mind that can experience visual objects. And the mental consciousness is that aspect of the mind that experiences mental objects such as thoughts, emotions, and memories. So we can talk about the six consciousnesses from the perspective of six types of objects. But again, we're not talking about six different consciousnesses, six different minds, six aspects of one mind. So that's one way of sort of dividing up the mind into different aspects. Another way we can sort of divide up the mind is in terms of function, how the mind functions. How does the mind function in every one of our experiences? And so here, in Buddhist psychology, normally the mind is divided into two. You'll see a division into what's called main mind and mental factors. So main mind is that aspect of the mind that is simply responsible for the raw experience, the raw entity of the object itself. Whereas mental factors are all the other aspects of the mind that will determine what type of experience we have of that object. So, for example, let's say we are looking at this cup, then the main mind part of that experience is simply experiencing the raw cup itself. And the mental factors are filling in the experience. What sort of experience are we having of this cup? And mental factors here, we can make a list of hundreds of them if we want, but generally in Buddhist psychology, they come up with a list of 51. And within that list of 51, of course, we're not going to go through them all because this is a whole topic itself in Buddhism. You could spend a whole week on this. But just briefly, to get an understanding of what these mental factors could be, in the list of 51, 26 of them are what's called mental afflictions. And so mental afflictions are things like anger, jealousy, craving, fear, anxiety. Anything that agitates the mind is a mental affliction. And so you can see in the list of 51, more than half are mental afflictions, which seems to suggest that our mind doesn't function very well. That a lot of the time it's like dysfunctional. So here we have a list of 26. And in this list of 26, that's in what's called the 6 root mental afflictions and 20 secondary mental afflictions that come out of those 6. And those 6 you can further condense to 3, often called the 3 poisons: ignorance, attachment, and aversion. So these are the 3 core mental afflictions that are the root of everything else, all the other mental afflictions. And ignorance here is specifically our ignorance or misunderstanding of the nature of reality. Because the Buddhist assertion is that that's the root problem, is we have a distorted view of reality. And from that, we end up with these 2 primary mental afflictions. And the primary ignorance here that we can talk about is this belief that there's a me here and an objective world out there, independent objective world. And because of that, then what happens in our experiences, when we experience something pleasant, we go, I want that. So we end up with attachment because we think that's going to make me happy. Or if we have some unpleasant experience, we end up with aversion because that seems to be the source of my suffering. So this belief of subject-object duality, there is an objective world there, leads to attachment to pleasant things, aversion to unpleasant things, and then all the other mental afflictions come out of that. Jealousy, craving, all come out of this fundamental problem here. So these are the 3 poisons, the 3 core mental afflictions on the list of 26. But of course, in the mental factors, we also have virtuous mental factors like love, compassion, patience, and so forth. And to mention a couple of other mental factors here briefly that are very important that we'll touch on a little bit today. One, of course, is mindfulness. Mindfulness in Buddhism, the word from Sanskrit Pali, the original word, literally means to remember. So mindfulness is remembering, not forgetting. So mindfulness is our ability to remember the object, i.e. our ability to hold or focus on an object without becoming distracted. Now, of course, our mindfulness is very poorly developed. We try to focus on something and then usually quickly we're completely distracted. So here, this is something we are trying to strengthen in meditation, and we're going to be primarily looking in our meditation part of the today. Primarily, we're going to be looking at this, how to strengthen mindfulness, because all of the other practices are based on this. You know, of course, things like love, compassion, a wisdom of nature of reality, this is all very important practices, but if we don't have this, We can try to develop love, compassion, and an insight into reality and meditation for a long time without really going anywhere, because we try to meditate on these things and then we're just thinking about all sorts of things. So the basis of all meditation practices to make them effective is to strengthen this. So that's what we're going to be focusing on today, how to strengthen this mindfulness. And then a couple of other couple other mental factors here that just to briefly mention that are very important. One is called intention. And that's what directs us towards an object. And so intention is a very important mental factor. And this comes up a lot, of course, in the Buddhist theory of karma, the law of cause and effect in terms of our actions. So that's a very important mental factor. There's another mental factor here that gets a lot of attention in Buddhism. And that's the mental factor of feeling. And this is another classic example of how terminology can sometimes be confusing. Because normally when we see the word feeling, what do we think of? Emotions. In Buddhism, the word feeling doesn't mean emotion. The word feeling in Buddhism is translation of Sanskrit word vedana, which this mental factor is simply responsible for, or all it does is it experiences things as either being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So this mental factor of feeling is simply experiencing, as part of how the mind functions, is simply we experience things as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. This is a very important mental factor because it's on the basis of this that we start to end up with problems, because usually on the basis of our pleasant experiences, we end up with attachment. To our unpleasant experiences, we end up with aversion. So this gets a lot of attention in Buddhism in terms of identifying it and not reacting to it. So that's another mental factor there that gets a lot of attention. Together with that, there's another mental factor that gets a lot of attention called discrimination, or sometimes translated as discernment. This mental factor simply is our ability to distinguish one thing from another. So the fact of in our experience being able to distinguish that this is actually a cup is this mental factor. So we can see, and so if we can't clearly distinguish the object, if we get that wrong, then of course it can lead to a lot of problems. If we don't clearly see things as they are in front of us. So both these mental factors cause a lot of problems. We react to our pleasant, unpleasant experiences, and we don't discern things clearly in an accurate way. Both of those lead to a lot of problems in our behaviour, and so these two mental factors get a lot of attention in Buddhism because of that. We are trying to not react, to see our pleasant, unpleasant experiences without reacting, and we're trying to improve this so that we can more clearly distinguish things. So these two get a lot of attention in Buddhism. And then, of course, there's a whole lot of other mental factors. As I mentioned, this is a whole topic in itself called Lo-Rig in Tibetan. And if you're interested in this, there's a very nice, very good book called Mind and Its Functions by Geshe Rapton that you might like to read. And, of course, there are lots of teachings in the Buddhist, in this group is part of the FPMT, and they have a program, basic program, where this is one of the topics, this topic of Lo-Rig. It's a very important topic. So that's a little bit in terms of how the mind functions. Any questions on that before we briefly look at the third presentation of mind before we go for a little tea break? Again, this is a very brief introduction. This is a huge topic. Okay, third presentation. we can talk about the mind in terms of different levels of the mind. And usually here in Buddhism, we divide it into three levels: coarse, subtle, very subtle. This is of particular interest in Buddhism because the more subtle we can make our mind, the more powerful it is. So in meditation, one of the things we're trying to do in meditation is we're trying to gain access to a deeper level of our mind because it's more powerful so that we can use that to transform the mind. This very subtle mind is something we normally don't have any access to, but within Buddhism, in the field of Tantra or Vajrayana practice, this is what the main goal is. In Tantra or Vajrayana practice, there are practices that help us to gain access to this very subtle mind, sometimes called the clear light mind. And if we can gain access to that in meditation, that's a very powerful mind. We can use that in our coming to realize the nature of reality, and we can accelerate the spiritual path to enlightenment. So the deeper the level of mind we can gain access to, the more powerful. And so normally in the normal Buddhist presentations, we're only really talking about this level of mind, and we're trying to sort of subdue the coarse mind. We're trying to make it more stable, more calm, more clear, more focused. And so that's what we're going to be looking at actually today, is how to train this coarse level of mind. The coarse level of mind is the one that's active now in daily life. To gain access to these levels of mind takes a little bit more deeper level of practice. So we're going to be focusing on how to train the coarse level of mind, how to make it more calm, more clear, more focused. But there are these levels available, particularly in Tantra Vajrayana, how to gain access to this. So that's another way of looking at the mind. So, of course, this is a very brief introduction. And then there's one more point I want to mention before we take a tea break. And that is, in general in Buddhism, everything is created through causes and conditions. What's called substantial cause and cooperative conditions. To use a simple example, a plant. The substantial cause of anything is the thing that transforms into the result. So the substantial cause of a plant, of course, is the seed. It's the seed that transforms into the plant. But for that seed to transform into the plant, we need lots of cooperative conditions. We need soil, sunlight, water, fertilizer. Without these cooperative conditions, a seed will never transform into a plant. So for a plant to exist, it needs the substantial cause, because without a seed, you're not going to get a plant. But also you need all the conditions for that transformation to take place. So from a Buddhist perspective, everything that exists, is produced through substantial cause and cooperative conditions. Everything. Not only in the physical world, but the mental world. So what this implies is that, and we'll start with the physical world, what this implies actually is that there is nothing moving through time. Superficially, it seems like this cup is moving through time. Seems like this was the same cup that was here yesterday, it'll be the same cup here tomorrow. That's how we interact with things around us in this way, don't we? But intellectually, don't we know that this cup has no stability? Hasn't science proven that this cup is changing in every single moment? That at the molecular level, there's just constant change. Isn't that a fact? Didn't we learn that at school? Do we accept that fact? I think we do. So I think none of us have a problem with accepting that this, intellectually, that this is changing in every single moment. Is that how we relate to this cup? No. So there's a problem. We're out of sync with reality. Our behavior is out of sync with reality. And from a Buddhist perspective, whenever we're out of sync with reality, problems arise. So therefore, and this is part of what's called the wisdom practice or Vipassana practice, is to bring our intellectual understanding into experience, to come to realize experientially, for example, that this cup is changing moment by moment. So therefore, if we can experientially see this cup is changing moment by moment, we are relating to this cup and everything else in a correct way, actually then it becomes very difficult, if not impossible, to develop attachment or aversion, for example. For example, if we are experiencing something pleasant, let's say we see some nice flowers and go, oh, they're really beautiful, and experientially we realize those flowers are changing moment by moment, how can we have attachment? What is there to grasp? There's nothing there to grasp because it's just change. So experientially, it would be illogical, experientially, even to try to grasp, because experientially we can see there's nothing there to grasp. There's just change. And at the same time, enjoying that beauty. This is the problem, is intellectually we may appreciate that, but experientially we go, those flowers seem to be the source of my happiness. There's something there I can grab. And we try to grab it with attachment and craving. We have all sorts of problems. So therefore, we can understand through this that everything is constantly changing. That at the physical world level, there's nothing moving through time. There's just a flow of change. And if we can appreciate that experientially, we're in sync with reality, we can enjoy that flow without trying to grab it and grasp it. Similarly, the mind is created through causes and conditions. What is the substantial cause of the mind we have now? The mind of a moment ago. The mind of a moment ago transforms into the current mind, and the current mind will transform into the mind of the next moment. But for that transformation to happen, we need a lot of conditions. For example, maybe our mind is now full of anger, but before it was calm. So for that calm mind to transform into the mind of agitation or anger, we need conditions. Maybe one of the conditions is we saw a person we don't like, and that condition enabled that transformation to happen. So similarly, experientially, we feel as if the mind is moving through time. But there's no such thing as a mind moving through time. Just like there's no such thing as a cup moving through time. There's just a flow of change. So the mind is not, like all the physical world, the mind is not a thing that moves through time. There's no mind that goes through time. There's no mind that goes from life to life. This is completely illogical. So therefore, what we talk about is the continuum of mind, the continuity of mind. So just like the physical world is just a continuum of flow of change, the mind is similar. There's just a flow of change unfolding. That's called the mind. Just like this flow of change here, we call a cup. That's fine. But then to grasp onto this cup as something solid and moving through time, or to grasp onto the mind as a thing moving through time, is out of sync with reality. So therefore, the mind is a continuum, a flow of change. Now, also an implication of this is within physics, for example, one of the fundamental principles of modern physics is the idea of conservation of mass energy. Meaning you can't create mass energy, you can't destroy it, you can only transform it. Which means when physicists start to posit the origins of the universe, they have to be very careful. You know, that not now one of the popular theories, of course, is the Big Bang. But within the Big Bang theory, I don't think any of the physicists are saying, oh, the universe comes from nothing. because that violates fundamental principles. They usually say some infinitely dense thing exploded, and then maybe later it'll contract again. But they wouldn't say it's coming from nothing. Likewise, here in Buddhism, we have the same theory of mind, conservation of consciousness. You can't create it, you can't destroy it, you can only transform it, which means there's not a point where the mind popped into existence. It's illogical. Just like physicists would not say the universe popped into existence at some time. Illogical. Similarly, the mind didn't just pop into existence. It violates fundamental principles, which means beginningless mind, just like beginningless world. So this is an implication of the Buddhist theory of mind, is this conservation of consciousness. It's not created, it's not destroyed, we can only transform it. So that's what I wanted to mention. We've got a couple of minutes if there's any questions, otherwise we'll go for a tea break. And then we'll move on to meditation in the next session.
Can I just ask, because I'm not quite sure about whether I've got it right, about the idea of time.
Right.
The idea of continuum. The idea of objects, mind, whatever it may be, as a flow of change. I mean, what is time? Could you explain how
our notion... No, I don't know. So, again... it's a huge topic again, but to give maybe a brief answer is... I mean, also in physics, you know, historically they used to think that time was some objective, linear, fixed thing.
Yeah.
That's proven to be false. So same, similar with Buddhism, is that... And this comes really into the topic of the Vipassana practice, the insight practice, the nature of reality, is that like everything else, from a Buddhist perspective, time is simply a concept that we've developed to help explain experience. So time is a concept we've developed to help understand flow. So it's not like there's time and within that there's everything changing. So there's no objective time from a Buddhist perspective. But what we need to be careful of is not flip to the other extreme saying, oh, no objective time, then time doesn't exist or time's a complete fabrication. That's the other extreme. So we're trying to find that middle way. That's the tricky bit. Because for us, there seems to be only two possibilities now. That either things are objective and function and real, or they don't exist at all. We don't see any other possibility. So often what happens is, in Buddhism, when we investigate this supposed objective, real, functioning world, and we go, hang on, it's not like that, what often people do is just flip to the other extreme. Oh, therefore there's no world, nothing exists. But the Buddhist assertion is saying that this is the two extremes, we need to find the middle way. And that's quite tricky. That's a whole huge topic. So time exists from a Buddhist perspective, but it's not some objective, independent thing.
No, so basically it's just our sort of...
Making sense.
Really.
Yeah, it's the same as this.
The idea of flow.
Yeah, exactly, it's the same as this. Exactly, same as this. I mean, if we look at it even from a physics perspective, there's just a flow of change.
Yeah.
And within that flow, to make sense of it, we develop a concept cup. And that cup can help us to make sense of the flow here. No? But if we think that there is a cup there, independent of everything, then there's a bit of a problem.
So are we kind of... if you think about mindfulness,
yeah,
about the way that everything exists in a single moment, you know, the sort of expansiveness, are we... So if we think of all existence, everything, you know, as a, you know, as a breadth rather than a depth, then our concept of time somehow fits within.
Again, time is just another concept that we've developed and a necessary, useful concept to make sense out of experience. Yeah, exactly. Okay, let's break for a tea break, and then we'll come back and start to look at meditation.